Welcome to this special edition featuring investigator perspectives on optimal strategies and emerging concepts in the management of genitourinary cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Dan Petrylak, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So this patient is a 47-year-old male who presented with gross hematuria in early to late 2012 and had a biopsy performed of his bladder, which demonstrated muscle-invasive disease. And he was devastated by the diagnosis. He has young children, young wife, and then went on to receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by cystectomy. And we had an extensive discussion as to whether he should be treated adjuvantly or neoadjuvantly, but we decided based on the data to go forth with neoadjuvant therapy first.
And can you talk a little bit about the data that you considered in making that decision?
Well, the two trials that we discussed, one was the SWOG study 8710, randomizing patients to three cycles of MVAC plus cystectomy versus cystectomy alone, and that demonstrated survival benefit. And we also talked about Reg Hall's trial in Europe, where he also showed a 8% improvement in overall survival on a long-term basis in favor of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And that study used both radiation therapy as well as cystectomy as the primary treatment for the bladder cancer.
So in his case, first of all, how did he tolerate the neoadjuvant treatment?
Extremely well. He had no episodes of neutropenia or neutropenic fevers, and he went right to cystectomy after the chemotherapy was completed.
And what was your take in terms of response to treatment?
I was disappointed. He had node-positive disease. He also had invasion into the perivascular fat. So he was at an extremely high risk for relapse after his surgery.
So he goes for his radical cystectomy. What happened post-op?
So we had, at that time, we had the open randomized trial of Nuvenge versus placebo for those patients who were HER2-new positive on their pathology specimens post-cystectomy, and he qualified for that trial, and he randomized to the Nuvenge arm.
What is Nuvenge?
Nuvenge is like Provenge. This is a dendritic cell product that is raised against HER2-new and supposedly targets HER2-new positive cells.
That's interesting. So this is HER2-positive bladder cancer?
Yes.
How often does that occur?
It's actually a little more frequent than people realized. Maha Hussain and I published a paper a number of years ago looking at HER2-new expression in metastatic disease, and that seemed to correlate with the poor prognostic factors such as liver metastases and bone metastases. We actually looked at the combination of trastuzumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel, and gemcitabine. Had a survival rate that was similar to what we saw in some of the other phase 2 trials with GemCis alone. But remember, again, that was a poor prognosis group of patients, and unfortunately, that never was followed up on.
But again, what fraction of bladder cancer is HER2 positive, roughly?
It's about 30%.
Really? And have anti-HER therapy been utilized? You mentioned the one study, but any other trials?
So Tom Pals did a randomized study of lapatinib post-chemotherapy. This was a randomized trial. Patients received 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy and then went on lapatinib maintenance. And unfortunately, it didn't show any improvement in progression for your overall survival. There have been some phase 2 trials that have been performed in the second line, but nothing that's really been showing significant activity.
That's interesting. You know, at the last ASCO meeting, there was a paper in colon cancer, metastatic HER2 positive, which is, you know, very uncommon, where they saw pretty good responses to lapatinib trastuzumab. Has that been tried in bladder cancer?
That's not been tried to my knowledge.
Interesting. What was the next step then?
The next step was after the 3 cycles of Nuvenge, then observation, and he progressed about 6 months after he completed his Nuvenge therapy with a very, very small pelvic lymph node. We then did a subsequent CT scan, which showed a 1.5 centimeter pelvic lymph node, which was felt to be recurrent cancer.
So no other evidence of disease?
No other evidence of disease.
And he was asymptomatic, I imagine.
He was asymptomatic.
So what was your thinking at that point, both non-protocol options and protocol?
Well, this patient relapsed within a year of his initial chemotherapy and cystectomy. So I basically treat these patients as if they were second-line patients. And so our thought was to enter him on a clinical trial, which we had the atezolizumab trial open at that time. The other options would have been to go on standard chemotherapy, which unfortunately we know has response rates of at best 20%.
What about the question of biopsying this one lesion?
Well, it was in a position that we could not safely biopsy him. That was actually debated at a number of different tumor boards. We could not biopsy him to confirm.
Particularly if there hadn't been a trial available, would observation have been an option?
The fact that it grew through two CT scans, I think, was enough for us to say that he had progressive disease.
So he went on this trial. First of all, can you talk a little bit about what atezolizumab is?
Sure. So atezolizumab is an anti-PD-L1 antibody that has shown activity in patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma, breast cancer, lung cancer. It basically blocks the inhibition of the immune system, and it's a checkpoint inhibitor. And there have been a number of different drugs that have been tried in that particular space, either anti-PD-L1 or anti-PD-1.
And I guess this is an anti-PD-L1 agent, as opposed to, for example, people are very familiar with nivolumab and pembrolizumab, they're anti-PD-1. What I've heard in terms of mechanism is the anti-PD-L1 agents like this one bind the ligand.
Correct.
Whereas the others bind the receptor.
Exactly.
So far, it kind of seems like they're pretty similar in different tumors. Any way to distinguish them?
So far, no. Theoretically, there's less toxicity, pulmonary toxicity with the PD-L1 drugs, but there has not been a good head-to-head comparison of the two.
So he went on this study. What happened?
So at his first evaluation, he had a partial response, and then subsequently he's now converted to complete response. He actually received his one-year dose about 2 weeks ago.
Wow. What's the thinking in terms of how long he's going to remain on treatment?
That's a good question. My feeling would be to continue as long as they are not having significant toxicities. About the only major issue that he has a dry mouth. And that's thought to be related to the stimulation of the immune system. But other than that, he's tolerated the treatment absolutely well.
Dry mouth. Are you thinking like sort of a Sjögren's syndrome?
Yes. I mean, we've seen this in a variety of different patients who've been treated with checkpoint inhibitors.
Really? I've never heard anybody say that. That's fascinating. Anything particularly specific about it clinically?
Nothing specific clinically. We had him evaluated by the ENTs, and they thought this was related to his immune treatment.
So sort of autoimmune effects on what the salivary
glands.
Wow. Yes,
yeah.
That is really interesting. So nothing else besides that. He felt totally well, no side effects.
He's working. He's enjoying his family. He's doing really well.
Just out of curiosity, how does he compare that to the neoadjuvant chemo he got, the MVAC?
It's much, much easier. Much easier.
So that's interesting. And then again, in terms of how long, if were you thinking to continue, or what does the protocol stipulate?
Well, the protocol's been modified several times. Originally, it was just a year, and now they're allowing this to continue on as long as there's no untoward toxicity. If they discontinue, they can go back on treatment again if they do demonstrate progressive disease.
Now, did he have a PD-L1 assay done?
He did, but we are blinded to those results.
So people entered regardless of PD-L1.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting. And how often is the drug given?
The drug's usually is given every 3 weeks.
And can you talk a little bit? You've been very much involved with the research on this agent. Can you talk about specifically the trials that have been done, what they've shown, and what's been seen with other PD-1 checkpoint blockade?
So there was initially the excitement was generated from a phase one trial that's been presented originally by Tom Pals that was written up in Nature, and then we presented some follow-up data at ASCO last year. And basically, in that trial, we demonstrated that the PD-L1 expression was important to response and subsequent survival. Those patients who were strong expressors of PD-L1 had about a 50% response rate. Those who were weak expressors or non-expressors of PD-L1 had about an 11% response rate. Jonathan Rosenberg presented the phase 2 experience, 311 patients, at the ESMO meeting this year. And the response rate was somewhat lower, 27% overall. And it did seem to trend towards a better response in the PD-L1 positive versus the negative patients. It's too early to determine what the overall survival is for the 2+ and 3+ expressors, but the median survival for all patients, including the non-expressors, was 7 months. The PFS is about 2 months overall.
What about the duration of response? Of course, a lot of the excitement in the other tumors has been the prolonged duration. Have you had enough follow-up to see what it is in this situation?
Well, the only long-term follow-up we do have is from the phase one trial, and we have not yet reached the median duration as of our presentation last year. And interestingly, if you're PD-L1 positive or negative, it doesn't matter If you respond for a good durable period of time. The IHC status in the immune cells really does not correlate with the duration of response. And you could see a very similar early response pattern in the phase 2 trial that, again, if you respond, you respond well.
And have you had any patients, because you hear these stories with other tumors, who had the treatment discontinued for whatever reason, toxicity or any other reason, who remained in response?
We have not discontinued on our patients at this point. If they've progressed, we've discontinued them, but we have not discontinued anybody who's been responding.
Do you have patients who have had responses, for example, more than a year?
Yes, yes.
What's the longest that you've observed yourself?
The first patient we treated on a phase 1 trial, he started in March of 2013, and he progressed in January of 2015.
Wow, so almost 2 years. And so what did you do when he progressed, incidentally?
So he had a solitary node which was resected, and he's now without evaluable disease at this point. And we have a second patient also had nodal disease. He was treated around the same time, and he still is in a complete response.
Fascinating. And what about time to response? It sounds like this patient responded fairly rapidly. What have you seen in terms of the studies?
It's usually fairly rapid. It's usually the median time to response, if I remember correctly from the phase 1 trial, was somewhere around 40 days. So it's fairly quick.
What did you observe in terms of tolerability and toxicity issues?
Really didn't see much in the way of toxicity with this trial. I mean, fatigue, you sometimes see bumps in liver function tests. We had that with one patient. It wasn't necessary for us to give her steroids, but she eventually, with a break from treatment, her LFTs came down. So those are the major types of side effects we've seen thus far.
So total, how many patients roughly have been treated?
Probably somewhere in the upper 20s.
That's all? A total of in the...
At our institution.
Oh, no. What about in the studies, the two studies roughly?
So the two studies in the phase 1, it was 92, and in the phase 2 was 311.
So the kinds of thing, you know, you don't hear too much about anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 in terms of toxicity, although some things. I've heard about endocrine problems, hypothyroidism. Do you see any of that?
No, we haven't seen that.
Wow, interesting. Pulmonary toxicity, colitis?
Neither of those. We've not seen either of those.
Any reason to think it would be any different in these patients than in other patients?
I couldn't think of any reason why there would be a difference as opposed to other patients.
Interesting. You mentioned, which again, I haven't heard about the thing about dry mouth. What's the risk of that?
It's low. It's probably about 5%.
Interesting. Again, another thing we sort of hear about in the other tumors, there's a lot of question about, is a so-called pseudoprogression.
Right.
Where it looks like patients are getting worse, and in fact, it's sort of the beginning of a response. Have you observed that?
There's actually been some published data in bladder cancer. There was a great review in JCO within the last month, and the rate in bladder cancer seemed to be somewhat lower. I think it was around 5%. I have not seen true pseudoprogression. I know that Jonathan Rosenberg believes he saw one case in his group of patients treated at Memorial, but I really haven't seen it. And one of the contentions that this article made was that pseudoprogression may actually be more prevalent with the anti-CTLA-4s as opposed to the PD-L1s. So perhaps that's the reason why we really haven't seen it in bladder cancer.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about what's been seen with other antibodies.
Betsy Primack has published phase 1 data of pembrolizumab, a straight trial, 33 patients. Their selection criteria included PD-L1 positivity in the tumor cells, and she had about a 27% response rate in her patients. Her median survival was about 12 to 13 months. The median progression-free survival was about 2 months, the same thing that we saw with atezolizumab. That's moving forward to a randomized trial, and that trial has been completed. This trial compares pembrolizumab to best available chemotherapy, whether it be vinflunine in Europe or paclitaxel or docetaxel in the United States. And that trial is completed accrual for their overall goal. So that trial hopefully will read out within the next year or two. Nivolumab has been evaluated in a large phase 2 trial. Patients are entered irrespective of their PD-L1 status. These are patients, again, who've seen prior chemotherapy, the same as we've seen in Betsy's trial. And I believe there were close to 150 patients entered in this study. And it's closed, and we're waiting the data on that particular trial as well.
And what about other research? You mentioned the adjuvant study. What about first line?
As part of the IMvigor trial, which was the phase 2 study that looked at second line patients, there was a cohort of 100 patients that looked at frontline atezolizumab in patients who are otherwise ineligible for cisplatinum. So I think that we'll see some data hopefully within the next year on that group of patients. I understand that the pembrolizumab trial in the same patient population is now close to accrual. So we'll at least get a readout in the frontline setting as to what the activity is of checkpoint inhibitors.
So no phase 3 studies ongoing?
At this point, there actually are phase 3 trials designed. There's a trial that's looking at avolumab as maintenance therapy after chemotherapy in the frontline setting. It's randomized to avolumab versus placebo. There are other trials combining checkpoint inhibitors frontline, comparing that to chemotherapy. So there is a large randomized phase 3 trial that's being designed as well.
If you could make a guess based on indirect comparisons, what do you think the numbers would look like first line PD-1 versus chemotherapy, and maybe, let's say, focused on people with positive PD-L1 assays?
I think that it's going to be difficult because until that data comes out from both the pembrolizumab and the atezolizumab trial, I think we have really no idea as to what the response rates are going to be. We know that in neoadjuvant studies that there's upregulation of PD-L1 after chemotherapy. So the question would be, is this going to be the same level of efficacy in the pre-chemotherapy setting? Nobody really knows at this point.
What's the thinking? Again, you see this in various tumors. Sometimes I kind of wonder about it, of the idea of combining chemotherapy with a PD-1 antibody.
Well, I think the question is, what's the right sequence? There are some lung trials that are being performed that are giving the chemotherapy concomitantly with the immune therapy. Is that sequence of administration going to abrogate the effect of the immune cells? Nobody really truly knows. Are there better chemotherapies to give? Are there certain chemotherapies that may be more immunogenic than others? I think that these questions of sequence, as well as giving concomitant therapy, need to be clearly addressed. And we need some good phase 2 trials to help us direct the subsequent phase 3 trials.
What about the issue of combining anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibody with anti-CTLA-4? Obviously, there's a lot of interest of that in melanoma, and now it's being looked at in other cancers.
So there is an upfront trial comparing that approach to chemotherapy in patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma as frontline therapy. There are studies that are looking at ipilimumab plus nivolumab in urothelial carcinoma. So those are ongoing, and hopefully we'll have some data very shortly.
Any thoughts about why? I mean, it seems that this approach in bladder cancer, certainly it seems comparable in efficacy to what we've heard about in other cancers, particularly lung cancer, I would say. Any thoughts about the mechanisms here? We hear about mutational loads. Is that kind of what this is all about in terms of smoking?
I think that may have something to do with it. If one thinks that the higher mutational loads would present more antigen to the T cells, that may be one theory that explains it. These are tumors that are related to tobacco smoking, chemical carcinogens, and the antigen presentation or the antigens from these tumor cells may have some commonality, and that may be the reason why we're seeing such a great response with immune therapy.
You know, when you hear a novel therapy with no toxicity being used by itself, causing clear-cut responses in some cases for a long period of time. First of all, you kind of wonder, shouldn't that be enough information to have it available? I mean, I think anybody with a patient with bladder cancer hears that can think of patients in their practice that could benefit by it. And if it's not, what kind of data is required? What's your take on that?
Well, this is one of the reasons why atezolizumab was granted breakthrough status by the FDA in 2013. So this is the rationale for doing the large phase 2 trial. Hopefully, the FDA will decide positively sometime next year as to whether this is sufficient to go with breakthrough status or accelerated approval. Certainly, the trial met its endpoint. I think that this, to me, is evidence enough that we do have activity, and hopefully we're moving forward quickly.
Are there patients that you see right now in your own practice who you can't get on a trial who you would like to give this agent to? And Have you attempted to give any of the approved agents, for example, to patients like that?
I have done that. I've actually met with some success in getting nivolumab for patients with bladder cancer, and I was also successful in getting it for patients with kidney cancer before the FDA approval. So we've applied and we've talked to the insurance companies, and there are some other programs that are out there that may actually offer some backup for patients as well.
That's interesting. Have you seen any responses outside of trial setting?
Yes.
Wow. You mentioned this, the question of people who aren't eligible for platinum therapy. And of course, I think about older patients or frail patients. First of all, have you attempted to use nivolumab or checkpoint inhibitor off study for patients like that?
No, I haven't. That I have not done.
How often do you see that you have a patient you really don't want to give chemo to?
It's probably about 30% of all patients. A patient who's platinum ineligible accounts for 30 to 40% of all patients. Now, that's a varying definition that includes neuropathy, congestive heart failure, hearing loss, and of course, renal dysfunction. So it's probably pretty rare that there's somebody that I can't at least give single agent chemotherapy to. If their performance status is so poor, I think they probably shouldn't be treated with anything at that point. It's unlikely they'll respond. But I think that, again, I think we need to understand better the mechanisms before we start moving into the untreated patients.
In those patients you use single agent therapy, which agent?
Single agent, I've used gemcitabine.
Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the other issues out there? Obviously, this is an extremely exciting one that are being looked at in bladder cancer in general from a research perspective.
So moving all the way up front to non-muscle invasive disease, we know that BCG is the standard of care for patients with CIS. And of course, there are limited options once a patient fails BCG. Cystectomy obviously is one treatment we would like to avoid, but can these checkpoint inhibitors either enhance the activity of BCG or be used as salvage after patients have progressed on BCG? So that's, I think, one very, very important research area.
So systemic, though, checkpoint inhibitors.
Right, systemic checkpoint inhibitors.
Interesting.
Then, of course, is the question of adjuvant versus neoadjuvant therapy. Unfortunately, we've not had an adjuvant trial that's shown a survival benefit, although adjuvant therapy is used in certain high-risk patients. And then I think the third portion we've talked about is how do we improve the role of systemic therapy in patients who are metastatic? So I think there are really three areas to focus on.
Right. We'll spend the rest of our time talking about prostate cancer, and maybe we can start out with your 58-year-old man.
So this is a gentleman who was having a history of recurrent lower back pain that became more pronounced over the summer. And he started noticing some numbness bilaterally in his buttocks over a period of time, and it progressed to pain that radiated from the lower back. And he had a PSA drawn that was about 260. And he was found to have, on PET scan, a pelvic mass plus a lesion at L2. He underwent a CT-guided needle biopsy of the sacral mass and was found to have metastatic prostate cancer, and it started on androgen blockade. And after about 2 months of androgen blockade, he's now started chemotherapy using the same protocol that was used in the CHARTED trial.
And can you talk about why you use the strategy of starting with endocrine therapy first and then bringing in chemotherapy?
It's variable. He came to us for another consultation and it was decided to give chemotherapy at that point. He wanted a little time to think about it. There are a variety of different ways I've seen this done. There's some people who give the endocrine therapy along with the chemotherapy on day one together. The studies basically administer the chemotherapy within 3 to 4 months. This is CHARTED and STAMPEDE of a patient entering on trial. The question is there a difference in the pharmacokinetics with testosterone being on board, especially when you're giving docetaxel? And there may be a little bit of a higher rate of neutropenia, neutropenic fevers, and that may be what explains the difference.
There was, you know, this thing that came out of breast cancer a long time ago was the idea of not giving hormone therapy and chemotherapy alone, you know, stasis from the hormone therapy. Any evidence that that's the case in prostate cancer?
I think, again, from the CHARTED trial, the evidence is that there's a great effect of giving early chemotherapy, you know, a 10 to 18 month difference in the median survival, much, much greater than what you expect when you give it later. Now, why is there a difference here? Well, we know that taxanes do affect the androgen receptor, and they basically inhibit the trafficking of the androgen receptor into the nucleus. It's possible that the taxanes are causing the additional effect of giving more quote-unquote endocrine therapy or affecting the endocrine axis. The other thing I think is intriguing is the fact that we know that resistance to abiraterone and enzalutamide is mediated in part by a splice variant called ARV7. And this is a truncated version of the androgen receptor that does not require ligand for activity. And thus, abiraterone and enzalutamide are inactive in patients who express this. So we know that chemotherapy is not affected by the ARV7 pathway, and patients do respond who are ARV7 positive to taxanes as well as other cytotoxic agents. So that may be wiping out some of those clones early on. And I think there are multiple reasons why chemotherapy has activity in this setting.
You brought up the issue of the splice variants, ARV7. Any evidence that you see that up front, or is that usually after a patient's been treated with hormone therapy?
It's usually after a patient's been treated in hormone therapy. And in fact, you can cause that clone to regress by giving back testosterone. This splice variant may be related somehow to packaging of the androgen receptor from the nucleus, and the hormonal axis may be involved in that. There's a trial that's being done at Johns Hopkins with giving testosterone back to patients who are castration resistant, and this is one of the rationales for doing this.
So they get testosterone and hormone therapy, or just testosterone?
They get testosterone given back after they progressed on hormone therapy.
Wow, have they seen responses?
They've seen some responses. They've reported that. The problem, of course, is you'll also see, as has been reported in other studies, disease progression. So again, molecular markers are important to understand what's going on here.
And they see the ARV7 splice variant go away?
It's been shown in the laboratory, yes.
But not yet clinically?
Not yet clinically.
Now, is this pharmacologic doses of testosterone, or?
I believe it's physiologic. I'd have to look back on the paper.
Right. We're going to get more into that in a second. You mentioned the CHARTED study, which was the big ASCO plenary presentation a couple years ago, and then more recently at the last ASCO meeting, the STAMPEDE trial. Can you talk about those two studies?
Sure. Well, the CHARTED trial was started in 2005. It was for metastatic-only patients. Originally, it started out with only poor-risk patients, but it was expanded, randomizing between immediate androgen blockade for metastatic patients plus chemotherapy versus androgen blockade alone. And a survival benefit was seen in those patients who were considered to be high risk, in other words, more than 4 lesions on bone scan, or having liver metastases. For the low-risk patients, it's not mature yet, so we still have not seen a survival benefit. Overall, there was a survival benefit when all patients were considered. STAMPEDE was performed in Britain. This is a randomized trial that took best standard of care versus an experimental treatment. So the best standard of care was androgen blockade. These were patients with locally advanced or metastatic disease randomized to chemotherapy with docetaxel plus hormones versus hormones alone. So for the M0 patients, there was an improvement in failure-free but not overall survival in favor of the chemo-hormonal therapy. There was a survival benefit in those patients who were M1 or metastatic in favor of chemotherapy, and that difference was about 10 months.
Where does this leave you? Initially, when the CHARTED data were presented, a lot of investigators were kind of following the trial and were only using chemotherapy with a greater tumor bulk involved. Did you do that then, or are you doing it now?
You know, I thought that at that time I was offering it to everybody, but I was being more emphatic with those patients who had high bulky disease. And I left it up to the patient who had low volume disease to determine for themselves from the data, because we didn't have the data to support that. Now, with STAMPEDE, there was no selection based upon disease extent. So I'm more comfortable with saying to a patient who has a lower volume of metastatic disease that you should consider chemotherapy. But I point out the other negatives about that as well, also the JUTUG trial.
So how has this incorporation of docetaxel earlier on affected your use of chemotherapy later on, specifically choosing between cabazitaxel and reusing the docetaxel?
So thus far, it hasn't affected it. And the reason I don't think it will affect it, although I could be wrong, is that this is using a fixed number of cycles of docetaxel. We're not stopping patients because they have progressive disease. When we were doing the original phase 1 and phase 2 trials with docetaxel, we allowed for intermittent chemotherapy. In other words, if their PSA is normalized, we then stopped their chemotherapy and then restarted them again if they became symptomatic and their PSAs rose. And in general, if you had a good response initially, you responded again. I mean, it was a very high chance or probability of response. So I don't know whether this is going to affect the sensitivity. And I think we clearly need trials as to whether you should switch to Cabazi or go with Doci as the first line therapy if you've had it as adjuvant treatment. We really don't know at this point.
Where do we stand right now in terms of trials comparing the two?
There's a large randomized trial that's comparing docetaxel to two different doses of cabazitaxel. It's completed accrual. I think we may hear within a year whether there's a survival benefit to one versus the other.
Any predictions?
I think that it's going to be very difficult to see a survival difference because of the subsequent second-line therapies that are out there. We've seen this with other trials that you tend to dilute your survival benefit out with a number of agents that are approved.
You could imagine that there might be other endpoints that might be important in deciding, you know, progression-free survival, response rate, and also tolerability. What do you think you might see there?
In general, I've seen a little bit that cabazitaxel is a little better tolerated than docetaxel. You don't tend to see neuropathy. You have a little more diarrhea and you have a little more neutropenia, which can be taken care of with colony-stimulating factors. Docetaxel, you have the edema issue, which can be difficult to treat with diuretics if it does become significant. You also have fatigue with docetaxel, which I think is a little bit worse than with cabazitaxel, but that's just a general impression I've had.
What about efficacy?
I think they probably will turn out to be similar.
Let's finish out talking about your 77-year-old man.
So this gentleman had a radical in 2007. He underwent androgen blockade in 2012 when he progressed. And in late 2013, he had a rising PSA to 12, plus he had a mass in his pelvis and right-sided hydronephrosis. He started abiraterone and prednisone. His PSA came down nicely to 2. He had improvement of the pelvic mass, but he developed a urinary tract infection and was admitted to the hospital. Also at the same time had severe transaminitis. He had an SGOT of 500. And he stopped his abiraterone and prednisone at that particular point. His LFTs declined over about a 2-month period, and his PSA then began to rise again. It was around 6. We put him on enzalutamide. His PSA went down to 0.2. And then in August of this year, he progressed and is now being treated with docetaxel and prednisone.
So the thinking with the LFTs was related to the abiraterone?
Yes.
How often do you see that?
A small percentage of the time, maybe 5%.
And you typically switch, or can you restart the abiraterone?
Well, I've tried numerous things like reducing the dose or giving them a break. Some patients I've been successful in doing that. Others I've had to switch them because their LFTs go back up again.
So this patient was not actually progressing, which maybe explains why he did so well on the enzalutamide.
Exactly.
How did he tolerate the two different endocrine therapies from a quality of life point of view?
So he had some fatigue on the enzalutamide. I think that when he was on the abiraterone initially, he did well, but then he developed the urinary tract infection and the subsequent problems. So he, for the time that he was on it, that he was not acutely ill, he did well.
What problems, if any, have you seen with abiraterone and anything specifically related to the corticosteroids?
I think that the corticosteroid dose is small, so I've not really seen any major effects with the steroids. I think the major problem with the steroids is once you're on them, it's hard to get the patient off of them. They do have trouble with fatigue after that. So I haven't seen really anything from that standpoint from the steroids major. Abiraterone, LFT abnormalities, fatigue, edema, those are the major things I've seen as toxicities.
How about enzalutamide? You mentioned the fatigue. Do you think this is some kind of central nervous system thing?
Well, we do know that enzalutamide does cross the blood-brain barrier. And the question is whether some of these newer generation antiandrogens have the same effect. We do know that there is an increased seizure rate with enzalutamide, particularly in those patients who've had prior chemotherapy. So, yeah, I do believe it's a CNS effect that's going on.
What else have you seen with enzalutamide?
There's an increased risk of falls. And whether that's central or whether that's related to sarcopenia and a little bit of muscle weakness is not really clear, but there does seem to be an increased fall risk with enzalutamide.
How do you decide which one to start first?
You know, clearly I like avoiding steroids if I can, so enzalutamide is one choice in that situation. But if I get the perception that a patient is frail, fatigued, and did not necessarily tolerate their primary hormone therapy well, I tend to go with abiraterone over enzalutamide.
Anything new in terms of the risk of seizures with enzalutamide? And are there any specific clinical situations in addition to just the history of seizures that get you to think twice about it?
Not really.
Have you given it to people who have a history of seizures controlled with medications?
I have not.
What about the combination of the two? I know that's been looked at a little bit.
So there's a randomized trial that's being done in the Alliance looking at enzalutamide versus Abby and enzalutamide. It makes sense to combine the two together because they do work by different mechanisms. As we know, Abby reduces testosterone synthesis and enzalutamide binds to the receptors. So one of the mechanisms of resistance to enzalutamide in addition to ARV7 is upregulation of testosterone synthesis. That's been shown by the MD Anderson group where Chris Logothetis did bone marrow biopsies and looked at testosterone levels and found that they went up after enzalutamide. So it does make sense to combine the two. Whether you're going to see a greater effect in combination versus sequentially is not clear.
So you referred a couple of times to the splice variant research. Can you talk about what that's looked at and what we know about that at this point?
Well, we know that in a patient, it's about a 10% rate in castrate-resistant disease initially. It goes up after treatment with abiraterone or enzalutamide. If you're positive for the splice variant, it's unlikely you will respond to either enzalutamide or abiraterone, whether that's as de novo resistance or acquired later on when they do develop and convert from negative to positive. So that's a good indication that they're not going to respond. Now, whether it's the V7 variant or whether it is actual androgen receptor levels is not clear at this point.
And I guess the thing that's been really interesting has been, I think the first time I saw this is about at the ASCO GU meeting in 2015 and then published, was the data with chemotherapy, with docetaxel.
Correct. And docetaxel seems to respond well in those patients who are V7 positive.
So globally, in a more typical patient who progresses after responding to one, what's the thinking in terms of response to the second one?
Without having a marker, the way I look at it is it's the old adage, if you respond for a long period of time, you may be more likely to respond to something else. So I will give Abby or Enza or vice versa a shot in the second line setting if the patient has contraindications to chemotherapy or if they've had a good long response and they have good performance status and they've got time. I generally will not try that in rapidly progressive disease.
And that also introduces the question, and you've been in a lot of our meetings where we've polled people, which is the question of using chemotherapy versus one of these two endocrine agents if they haven't had either. And I guess the one situation where if we write the question that the patient's symptomatic or has a lot of disease, you see a lot of people in practice thinking more about docetaxel. And yet, sometimes I wonder why, because it looks like the time to response and efficacy is maybe the same or even better with enzalutamide abiraterone.
I think, again, we need the molecular markers, and that's the problem. I think people are going on their clinical intuition, and a lot of times it's right, but unfortunately, we don't have a good way of predicting.
So this whole model in terms of ARV7, et cetera, has been really fascinating. And then I was reading about this agent, galadarone.
Right.
That's really fascinating. Can you explain what it is? I'm still trying to figure this out.
Galadarone has two major mechanisms of action. Like abiraterone, it has a lyase activity and reduces testosterone synthesis. But it also will downregulate androgen receptor levels. So that would be where the V7 mutant is seen. And so there's a randomized trial being performed of galadarone versus enzalutamide in patients who are ARV7 positive. And that study is the ARMOR trial. It is going for FDA approval in the pre-chemotherapy setting. And to my knowledge, this is the first de novo prostate cancer study that the FDA is permitting a progression-free survival endpoint as its primary endpoint.
It's really a fascinating concept. And I guess I've seen data, I think it was in a phase 2 trial, that I had responses, a number of responses in patients who had the splice variant.
Right, exactly.
So very different than what you see with abiraterone and enzalutamide.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really an awesome study, an interesting agent. Where do you see that heading?
Well, I mean, certainly you would see this in patients. They are required to have CTCs positive for ARV7. So I could see that heading into the front line in an ARV7 positive patient. I could see that being used in a patient who's progressed and is ARV7 positive as well after Abby or Enza. So I think that there are a couple of different niches for this to occupy.
You mentioned the fact that this assay has been done on circulating tumor cells. How often are you able to successfully do the assay? And where are we right now in terms of actually maybe getting it available?
So it's, you know, about half of patients will secrete or produce circulating tumor cells. So you're limited to your patient numbers. I'm not quite sure. I know there are labs that are trying to move this forward and become CLIA certified. So I think hopefully we are close, but I couldn't give you an exact answer.